So how did you get into doing that? Because people say, oh, it's very well, but how did you get the foot in the door?
Well, that in that way that Nick Clegg moans about. You know, he talks about middle-class parents elbowing their way into jobs and getting their kids good jobs. My dad was involved because he's been a guest on this show. He's done this slot with you, hasn't he?
Yes, he has, yeah.
Because I heard because he's a criminal defence lawyer, Paul Bacon.
Yeah.
And I heard him on here. I learned quite a bit about my mum and dad, but I listened, because you can listen to local radio in London now. I streamed the John Holmes Sunday morning show in London, in North London. And yeah, I learned quite a bit about him and my mum. The stuff they'd never bothered telling me. Such as he revealed to you on this show that my mum had seen the Beatles perform in Mansfield, and that it was the day they got their first number one. What was their first number one? Was it Please Please Me? I can't remember, but...
Yes, I think... some people say then you got to number two. It depends on the chart you looked at.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And that she'd seen them and they played, and that they'd been in a dressing room backstage in Mansfield when they found out they'd gone to number one. And I just thought, wow, my mum has told me a lot of stories less interesting than that. I can't believe she's never told me that.
Do you think your parents are going to learn anything about you?
Today? Well, yeah. We'll see. We'll have to see how this goes.
So the Fratellis we kicked off with.
Yeah.
That's just a great song. But any reason?
Because you asked me to pick seven or eight songs sort of from my life that mean something to me. And in my career, I think the two jobs I've had that have been the most out-and-out fun have been The Big Breakfast and a radio station called XFM. And the Fratellis reminded me of working at XFM, and they used to come in for sessions in the way that Jake did last night here. And it just takes me right back to working at that radio station.
And this is, I guess it might be from your parents, because it's the Beatles.
Yeah, which
tour? And I Love Her. People never play this, do they?
This is such a beautiful song. And let's not speak over the beginning, because it starts so well. But I recently bought a record player. And
I've heard about your vinyl collection.
I've got a vinyl collection. And it's just something so satisfying. A, about putting on a record, actually owning a record. Because of the size of it, the artwork looks better. Physically putting a record on a record player is a joy, and so much more satisfying than listening to something from iTunes. And here's what you do when you have a record player, is you listen to albums in the order that they were intended to be listened to, which I think you get away from now with digital music. And so this is from Hard Day's Night, the Beatles album, which is kind of midway through, isn't it? They're getting towards the middle of their career, and they're just becoming more confident. They're just becoming a little bit more experimental. Not as experimental as Sgt. Pepper, but here they're really finding their form, and this in particular is a beautiful song.
And I Love Her from the Beatles. Beautiful. Richard Bacon is my guest. And, you know, we played the Fratellis, a Chelsea Dagger. A text has come in. 5 hours till Panthers. Just need to be over there. Over then the programme drinks, etc., etc. I don't know who it comes from, because I can't read.
This is the ice hockey team.
Yeah, because they lost to Sheffield Steelers last night.
Oh, did they? Because that's always been the big rivalry, hasn't it?
Wound-licking. There's quite a few rivals now, but yes.
You can imagine that song, that Chelsea Dagger song, being played at a lot of sporting venues, because it's quite aggressive.
Oh, it is. So good luck to the Panthers. They get revenge today against the Sheffield Steelers, because of the return match today.
Great.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Now, Richard Bacon is my guest. Shall we talk about your early childhood then? Were you born in Mansfield?
Yeah. Yes, I was. Yeah, King's Mill Hospital. And my mum always says, and my sisters always say quite rightly, that I don't have a very good memory for my childhood. And I like, at the moment, looking through old family photos, because for some reason, I have a very good recall of the last 10 years. I have an all right recall of my 20s. And then somehow it becomes a little bit of a black spot. But I was born at King's Mill Hospital, and I lived in Mansfield till I was 20 at three different houses. And the house that I moved to when I was about 12 is the house that my parents still live in, and where I stayed last night.
Yeah. And that's important, I think. My father sold our house, the family home.
Was that hard?
And it wasn't the same going home.
No.
There was no focus. And we nearly sold our house here, and I could tell by the children, you know, think, well, that's our home, that's where we grew up. Don't lose it.
I agree, and I think that actually the bricks and mortar do carry with them, don't they, something that's quite hard to define and explain, but there is a character there. And that when I go back to my parents' house, you are plugged in instantly to your childhood. And there are rooms that I walk into, and instantly, as I say, I've got no memory. Certain aspects of my childhood and my time in Mansfield come back to me.
It's little bits of detail which we don't notice now, isn't it? When you when you're a child, you've noticed and you live with, and then for some reason or other, they start coming back again.
I still sleep in the same bedroom. I noticed the other day in the window in the bedroom, there's a little car sticker up in the top corner, which was, I remember, I noticed it, and it's something I had made when I was a naughty teenager, John. And I organised a couple of illegal raves, and I had these stickers made for them. And I spotted one still in the window in my parents' house, in the bedroom that I still sleep in when I go up there. But I do like, I like going up there. I like seeing them. I don't get up as much as my mum would like me to.
She's told me. But that's understandable. Parents don't understand that. So you've got St Peter's School you started.
Yeah, St Peter's School.
And then you got...
Which my mum is currently the chairman of the governors at St Peter's School, yeah.
And I would say that Christine Bacon, who used to work here at BBC Radio, she's very incestuous today.
She is, yeah.
she used to work here. But then you got a bit of a silver spoon, didn't you? Wellow House Prep and Worksop College.
Yes, I did, yeah.
It's a bit of a privileged education.
Yeah, very much so. They're both private schools. So I went to Wellow as a day boy. I boarded for the final term. Got in a bit of trouble at that school.
Because you've always been in trouble, you know.
I've always been in trouble. Yeah, yeah. It follows me around. Or either it follows me around or I actively run towards it.
Yeah, all right, then carry on.
/ encourage it. And enjoy it. Yes, I got into a bit of trouble there. I just made myself and my best friend. I can't remember what we did. We might have stolen something, but we used to get in trouble. And then he left. He got thrown out and I didn't. And then me and this best friend, Will Smith, teamed up again at Worksop College and got in more trouble. And he got thrown out a second time. And
you're a survivor, aren't you?
I was a survivor, yes.
Still are.
Do you know what? Yeah. It's absolutely true. I seem to have come through a few nuclear winters. But I loved those schools, and I think that actually they were a very important part of defining my character. That I have a sense of mischievousness about me. I probably am a bit naughty. And I think, in a way, there's certain points in my life and career where that has led me towards disaster. But I think in other ways it served me well, and particularly in the job that I do now. I think it's helped me not be too bland, almost, really. And so that spirit that I got from those schools, and a degree of confidence, to be honest, that came from those schools, has been very useful in the career that I've followed.
Certainly beautiful. I've been to the chapel at Worksop College.
It's an amazing place.
Oh, beautiful.
It's over 100 years old. The idea was it was going to be the Eton of the North. I read about the history of it once.
I believe that.
I think if we're being honest, it's never entirely achieved that status.
So your first job was at McDonald's?
Yeah, it was at McDonald's.
Not many people know that.
No, yeah, I worked at McDonald's in Mansfield. I was in Mansfield yesterday. I opened a jewellery shop for my father's friend, Andy Campin. I opened the Pandora jewellery shop and I walked past McDonald's and spared a thought. I did work there. I worked there on Friday and Saturday nights, and it was quite a violent shift in those days in Mansfield. I don't know what it's like now. And they used to park a police riot van outside McDonald's. So you knew that that was a centre of trouble. And people would come in. Quite often staff at McDonald's would have to go to court as witnesses for some act of violence that they'd witnessed in Mansfield McDonald's. I remember a guy giving me his order whilst he had another guy in a headlock. And he got the guy in a headlock and he was ramming his head against the counter while saying, "I would like a Filet-O-Fish, small fries and a vanilla shake." I witnessed a lot of that there. I have quite a short attention span, but I get very passionate and excited about things. And I remember for the first week or so thinking it was the most exciting job in the world. I was so intrigued by how it worked. It's still an amazing fact that how quickly the frozen meat goes from frozen to fully cooked in 44 seconds. You know, there's detail like that that I couldn't believe. And so I had a week of excitement. And then once I'd worked all that out, I then quite quickly got a little bit bored.
So when you came to Radio Notting, we've talked about the beat.
Oh, I mentioned what I was saying was my dad, being a lawyer, he was interviewed here a lot, and he got me some work experience, and then so he helped me get in.
Isn't it easy to get it now because of all the rules and regulations?
No, it's harder. It is harder.
It's very, very hard.
It is. I find that
really a shame.
I find that a shame.
But I think of the number of people who've come through the ranks here.
It's the same at Five Live now. I also co-own a TV company. There's now all sorts of rules governing who we can get in for work experience, and I find it sad. It's a great way to get in. But I did a day. I was very enthusiastic. They put me on the beat, and because I was like the McDonald's thing, I was really excited. But my excitement never dimmed, and kind of remains to this day with radio. And that was, by the way, how I got into the industry.
Nicole Kidman, you interviewed.
Well, that was really early.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. What happened was I did some freelance work in London whilst I was working here for a cable TV channel, and through that I interviewed Nicole Kidman, and it was through that occasional work that I got offered a full-time job in London.
So you were this live TV. You got banned from the state opening of Parliament?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Because we used to have a mascot on live TV, which was called the News Bunny, and it was a life-size rabbit outfit, and it used to sit behind the newsreader, and it would, if the newsreader was reading a good news story, the News Bunny would put his thumbs up, and if it was a bad story, he would put his thumbs down. And I used to write these news bulletins and report for them, and I took this rabbit down to the state opening of Parliament, and the Parliament has its own police, and the parliamentary police dragged us both away. And I have a letter from Black Rod saying that I'm banned for life from both houses of Parliament. And I have that framed. I've been back a few times. They're not very good at enforcing that ban, I must say.
I'm glad you got it framed, though.
It's hilarious. Live TV was just a fascinating place to work. It was owned by the Daily Mirror. It was based in Canary Wharf Tower. And it was mainly awful output with these occasional good ideas within it. And I made my first documentary there, which was called Behind the Scenes of Topless Darts on Ice, which I think in many ways is still some of my best work, John.
I think it's that's a runner for the future programmes, yeah. I think, with audience participation.
It certainly is. We should find that and get it on YouTube. It had this amazing ambition, live TV, beyond its budget. And so it had a daily soap opera that it couldn't afford to make properly. And so they used to film it around the office. So I remember writing a news bulletin at a desk, and at the end of this bank of desks were two people simulating having sex whilst being filmed for the daily soap opera. And then I'd have to sort of walk around that and go to the News Bunny and give him his instructions for the news. So it was
weird. A
weird place to work. They made a bid to buy the premiership, which was crazy, which they couldn't afford. And in the end, you won't be surprised to hear the entire thing folded.
Well, let's have some sanity now from Simon and Garfunkel.
This is a beautiful song. This is Kathy's song. The reason I picked this is because mainly of my wife, Rebecca, who is here in Nottinghamshire with me today, and our son, Arthur. But this is Rebecca adores Simon and Garfunkel, and as do I, as a result of her passion for these guys. I made a joke on air that got me in a lot of trouble. And I knew what I was doing. But
you did it again.
I know, yet again, you see. I'm a magnet for trouble. It's very much a theme. I actually wrote a book early this year, which was... it's meant to be a funny book, but it does contain a lot of these sorts of stories. And I was interviewed by Emma Freud on Radio 4, and she just read it. She's one of the first people to read it. And she said, the thing I noticed about you is you don't learn from your mistakes. And I thought, it's quite an astute observation. But this time I was on the radio, and I used to have a feature called Mundane Text, where I'd say to people, text in anything you like. And a guy texted in and said, I'm currently serving on a jury.
Hang on, we can do this, can we?
Huh?
We can do this.
Yeah, we can do it now.
Yeah, okay,
right. Yeah. No, it's eight years ago. He said, I'm serving on a jury, and so therefore, he goes, I can't tell you anymore because it's an active case. And I read this out, and I said on air, oh, come. Why don't you text back in, tell me all about the trial, and I'll tell you whether to go guilty or not guilty. And if you do that, you can have a My Chemical Romance CD. And then that was it. And I just made it obviously as a joke. And then the next day, two policemen turned up at XFM and took me down to Charing Cross Road Police Station. And I was interviewed under caution for 3 hours, and I had to hire a lawyer. And in the middle of this interview, so I'm in a grey interview room, and it turns out they had worked out who the juror was, so they seized our phone records at XFM, and it turned out he was serving on a murder trial, so they were taking it quite seriously. And I'm in this interview room, and these two policemen said, well, for the tape, we're now going to listen to the offending broadcast. And he opened up a laptop in the middle of the room, and he'd rewound it too far. So rather than just playing the link where I said these words, he'd rewound it to the beginning of the song I played before the joke, which was Green Day's Basket Case. And we sat in a police interview room, listening to the entirety of this song coming out of some tinny speakers.
Do you have the time to listen to...
You didn't get... One thing we ought to say, you didn't get sacked for it, did you?
No, because actually, what I was trying to do is what I thought was a clever joke, and so... in the end, it would only have been illegal if I'd given him the CD, and I didn't. They kept me waiting for 3 weeks before the CPS decided not to prosecute.
Yeah. Keep you waiting, that's neat. So, how did you get a job on Blue Peter? I tried for ages.
Did you?
I got fobbed off. They said I could do play school. I thought, I'm not hopping around like a bunny.
Here's a little known fact. Simon Mayo, who I took over from on 5 Live, who used to work here and has been a guest on this very slot.
Absolutely.
With you, John Holmes, on Radio Nottingham. He auditioned for Blue Peter and failed, whereas I auditioned and succeeded.
So third time and lucky. I auditioned, Simon auditioned, and you
did. You actually do the audition?
Well, I went and see Biddy Baxter and everything.
Did
she wrote on my thing, try play school.
Biddy Baxter is still around. She just received, she's about to receive a big honour from BAFTA, Biddy Baxter. Yeah. She's still great, fascinating, charismatic woman. She held the record. She was the editor of Blue Peter. I think she holds a world record for having a name on the credits the most amount of times on television. But I was at that Channel Live TV that was obviously a crazy place, run by Kelvin McKenzie, and I just sent in a tape when this guy called Tim Vincent left Blue Peter. And the tape was full of stunts. It had me getting banned from Parliament. It had Damon Albarn of Blur attacking me in the street for something else I'd done.
Threw beer over, didn't it?
Yeah. He was really upset with me. It had me running after James Hewitt after he'd been in court in Devon. So I thought either they'll get this tape and think, either they'll think, this bloke is interesting, let's give him a go. Or they'll think, this guy is bad news and dangerous and we shouldn't use him. And I'm afraid they made the wrong decision and decided to use me. And I went in for an audition and you jump on a trampoline and you do a mock show.
Oh, yeah, I would have been. Got that far.
I had to interview a chap whilst holding a python, made a Valentine's card, launched the appeal, and then got the show. But that was the process.
But then you had to leave.
I did have to leave. I can't remember why, John.
Can you really?
No, because...
Can I remember?
No, because when you take drugs, it really ruins your memory. I left after 20 months.
Why were you taking drugs?
Why was I taking drugs? Well, because those were the reasons we've already analysed, really, that some people are attracted to trouble and are a bit naughty. You know, the same reason that I got thrown out of school, in a sense.
You must have seen the danger in that. It's Blue Peter, crystal clear.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it obviously was stupid. I had taken drugs before I went to London. Once you've taken a few drugs, then the idea of taking drugs obviously isn't such a big deal. And so it was a bit of a continuation of my naughty spirit that I'd managed to develop whilst growing up and going to those schools. And I guess I was just a bit overexcited. I'd placed a lot of trust in a guy who was my best friend at the time, who I'd actually met here at BBC Radio Nottingham. And we just used to lead each other astray a little bit, and we had a big night where I got overexcited. And took quite a lot of cocaine. When did it start? It started in a pub in Richmond at about 6... and the night ended in a drug dealer's flat in Tottenham. And I remember walking into the flat and the dealer saying to me, "Aren't you that guy off Blue Peter?"
Really?
And I'm thinking, that might have been the most frightening and one of the lowest moments of my life. I mean, that was really awful. But yes, it's just a combination of the type of person I was, doing stupid things, hanging out with the wrong person.
But he threatened to didn't he blackmail you?
Well, no, he just went to a newspaper and recorded the phone call for Evan. He rang me a couple of weeks later and we rehearsed the details of the evening where he was saying, how much cocaine did we have? And I would, two wraps. All these details were on a phone call that were then printed in a newspaper. So he made £20,000 out of that. And it was certainly a difficult time. It's hard to explain. It became a very big news story.
Of course it did. What did you expect?
It was the... I went to my editor because I found out that I was going to be in the newspaper. And it was Blue Peter's 40th and I was followed by some photographers and it was weird. My PR guy was a former editor of The Sun. He knew what to do. And he rang me, and it was on a Saturday, and told me, actually, my dad... The criminal defence lawyer Paul Bacon had come to see me in London that day to repaint my flat. I remember the walls were yellow, and obviously that had to go. So we went down to Homebase, and before going to Homebase, I'd said to my PR guy, can you find out why some photographers are following me? And then we were coming back to my flat, and I got a can of midnight mist in my hand, and the phone went, and my dad was sitting next to me, and he was very proud of the fact I was a Blue Peter presenter. And the PR guy, Stuart Higgins, called, and he said, Richard, can you talk? And I said, well, briefly, and he said, it's news of the world, cocaine, and lots of it. But by lots of it, he meant lots of copy, big article. Sure. But I remember thinking at that moment that I would have to basically break my dad's heart, because for my mum and dad, that was, and I think always will be, the best job I could ever have.
You did break his heart?
Yeah.
Your mother says he burst into tears.
Yes, that's the only time she's heard him cry. He didn't cry in front of her. He went and hid in the shower on the Monday morning, knowing that he was going down to court that day, and he's in the legal profession, and that he'd have to face his colleagues and that kind of thing. So it was. I think it was harder for them than it was for me. I think about that a lot, actually, when I see scandals erupting, that sometimes weirdly easier for the principal than it is for their relatives, because it's confusing for relatives, and they're less in control. And actually, for that first week, there's so much going on around you, and I was getting all these calls inviting me onto TFI Friday and all sorts of shows, that it's hard, but there's a degree of excitement about it. Mm. It's only a few weeks later when I really reflected on it and thought, wow, what have I done?
So, what would you say to Arthur, your son?
What would I say to Arthur, my son?
Would you encourage him to do what you did?
To get a job on Blue Peter and take some drugs and get sacked.
You know what I mean.
I wouldn't encourage him to do it. I don't know what I'd say to him. I haven't really thought that through. I would encourage him not to do it, because in the end, no good comes of it. I mean, what happens is it essentially leads to bad decision-making. That's the problem with it. The problem with drugs in general, I mean, it can be the problem with alcohol, but it's exaggerated further by drugs, is that it leads to bad decisions. That's, I think, how I'd put it.
So you're all right now?
Yeah.
Mm. Clean?
Very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't an addict, John. It was, it was just something that I was doing
but you could have been
occasionally.
People stood by you after the after Blue Peter, didn't they? I mean, for a start, the BBC employed you again, which you must have. A lot of people wouldn't have been employed.
Well, not for a while. They didn't. I mean, I went to work on the Big Breakfast. So it's mentioned earlier that the most fun jobs I've had. And there were two that were particularly fun. One was XFM. And when I was at the station XFM, Ricky Gervais was there, Stephen Merchant, Jimmy Carr did the show before me, Zoe Ball did Drive Time. It was Adam and Joe were there. Yeah. Everyone was there. It was just a really extraordinary place at that time. The other one is The Big Breakfast, which I worked at for 3 years. And most of the time I was there, I was the roving reporter going around Britain. And that was the job that I had after Blue Peter, so that was Channel 4. And it was very much a place that suited people who got themselves into a bit of trouble. That's what I liked about it. It had just such a spirit, an outsider spirit. The main host, Johnny Vaughan, had been to prison for drug dealing. And I remember when it closed, and on the last day, we had this giant gnome in the garden. It was quite a famous prop at the Big Breakfast. And we had its hand manipulated, so it was flicking the bird. And live on the show, we sent it down to Channel 4's headquarters, because they decommissioned our show, and unveiled it. We left this massive 30-foot gnome flicking the bird at Channel 4. And I think, in a way, that sums up the attitude of that show.
But another person who stood by you, came up, well known actress, didn't she?
Sienna Miller?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I've got to know Sienna a little bit socially, out and about. And yes, I did have a night. It's about 3 years ago, and I was in a cab with her and Jude Law, and we had a long night out, and she said, just so you know, when you got sacked off Blue Peter, I was a viewer, and I was a fan, and I led a bit of a campaign, and I wrote to the BBC to try and get you reinstated, and I had a picture of you in my common room.
Really?
Which I thought was quite exciting.
Oh, not half.
Also made me feel quite old. Given that she's very successful and was young enough to be a child when I was presenting Blue Peter.